that appears more commonly among alcoholics than non-alcoholics, and confers susceptibility to at least one form of alcoholism. Or so they thought after examining the brains of a few dozen corpses. Even this more modest hypothesis, however, failed to stand up to future investigation. Subsequent studies were unable to confirm any association between the gene variant and alcoholism. The most important finding of research into a genetic role for alcoholism is that there is no such thing as a gene for alcoholism, writes the addiction specialist Lance Dodes. Nor can you directly inherit alcoholism. Whatever problem we are hoping to resolve or prevent, be it war, terrorism, economic inequality, a marriage in trouble, climate change, or addiction, the way we see its origins will largely determine our course of action. I present the case that the early environment plays a major role in a person's vulnerability to addiction, not to exclude genetics, but to counter what I see as an imbalance. Genes certainly appear to influence, among other features, such traits as temperament and sensitivity. These, in turn, have a huge impact on how we experience our environment. In the real world, there is no nature versus nurture argument, only an infinitely complex and moment-by-moment interaction between genetic and environmental effects. For this reason, as two psychiatrists at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine have pointed out, the liability trait for alcoholism is not static. Owing to developmental and environmental factors, the risk of alcoholism fluctuates over time. Even if, against all available evidence, it was demonstrated conclusively that 70% of addiction is programmed by our DNA, I would still be more interested in the remaining 30%. After all, we cannot change our genetic makeup, and at this point, ideas of gene therapies to change human behaviors are fantasies at best. It makes sense to focus on what we can immediately do, how children are raised, what social support parenting receives, how we handle adolescent drug users, and how we treat addicted adults. The current consensus among those who accept a high degree of hereditary causation for alcoholism is that predisposition to the disorder is about 50% genetically determined. Equally extravagant estimates are applied to other addictions. Heavy marijuana use is said to be 60 to 80% heritable, while the inherited liability to long-term heavy nicotine use has been calculated to be an astonishing 70%. Cocaine abuse and dependence are also reported to be substantially influenced by genetic factors. Some researchers have even suggested that alcoholism and divorce may share the same genetic propensity. Such high figures are beyond possibility. The logic behind them rests on mistaken assumptions that owe less to science than to an exaggerated belief in the power of genes to determine our lives. In genetic theories of mental disorders, unscientific beliefs play a major role, write the authors of a research review. It's not that genes do not matter. They certainly do. It's only that they do not and cannot determine even simple behaviors, let alone complex ones like addiction. Not only is there no addiction gene, there couldn't be one. Until recently, it was thought that there were 100,000 genes in the human genome. Even that number would have been inadequate to account for the unbelievable synaptic complexity and variability of the human brain. However, it has now been discovered that there are only about 30,000 gene sequences in our DNA, even less than in some lowly worms. Our DNA is simply too paltry to spell out the wiring diagram for the human brain, writes UCLA research psychiatrist Jeffrey Schwartz. Far from being the autonomous dictators of our destinies, genes are controlled by their environment, and without environmental signals, they could not function. In effect, they are turned on and off by the environment. Human life could not exist if it wasn't so. Every cell in every organ in our bodies has exactly the same complement of genes, yet a brain cell does not look or act like a bone cell, and a liver cell does not resemble or function like a muscle cell. It is the environment within and outside the body that determines which genes are switched on or activated in which cell. The cell's operations are primarily molded by its interaction with the environment, not by its genetic code, the cell biologist Bruce Lipton has written. There is a new and rapidly growing science that focuses on how life experiences influence the function of genes. It's called epigenetics. As a result of life events, chemicals attach themselves to DNA and direct gene activities. The licking of a rat pup by the mother in the early hours of life turns on a gene in the brain that helps protect the animal from being overwhelmed by stress, even as an adult. In rats deprived of such grooming, the same gene remains dormant. Epigenetic effects are most powerful during early development and have now been shown to be transmittable from one generation to the next without any change in the genes themselves. Environmentally induced epigenetic influences powerfully modulate genetic ones. How a gene acts is called gene expression. It is now clear that the early environment, consisting of both the prenatal and postnatal periods, has a profound effect on gene expression and adult patterns of behavior, to quote a recent article from the Journal of Neuroscience. One example is related to alcohol consumption. A certain variation of a particular gene, found in some monkeys, reduces alcohol's sedative effects and also its disorganizing and unpleasant influence on balance and coordination. In other words, monkeys with this gene are less likely to feel semi-comatose from drinking and less likely to lurch about like a drunken sailor. They have the capacity to imbibe greater amounts of alcohol without side effects and are more likely to drink until they're drunk. However, it was found that in mother-reared monkeys, the gene was not expressed. That is, it had no impact on drinking behavior. It did so only in monkeys who had been stressed in early life by being deprived of maternal contact and reared amongst peers. The overemphasis on genetic determination in addictions is based largely on studies of adopted children, especially of twins. I will not lay out here in detail the fatal scientific and logical flaws in such studies, but for those interested, I discuss them in Appendix 1. The important point to explore here is how stresses during pregnancy can already begin to program a predisposition to addiction in the developing human being. Such information places the whole issue of prenatal care in a new light and helps explain the well-known fact that adopted children are at greater risk for all kinds of problems that predispose to addiction. The biological parents of an adopted child have a major epigenetic effect on the developing fetus. The conclusions of many animal and human studies are best encapsulated by researchers from the medical school at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. In the past few decades, it has become increasingly clear that the development and later behavior of an immature organism is not only determined by genetic factors and the postnatal environment, but also by the maternal environment during pregnancy. Numerous studies in both animals and human beings have found that maternal stress or anxiety during pregnancy can lead to a broad range of problems in the offspring, from infantile colic to later learning difficulties and the establishment of behavioral and emotional patterns that increase a person's predilection for addiction. Stress on the mother would result in higher levels of cortisol reaching the baby, and, as already mentioned, chronically elevated cortisol is harmful to important brain structures, especially during periods of rapid brain development. A recent British study, for example, found that children whose mothers were stressed during pregnancy are vulnerable to mental and behavioral problems like ADHD, or to being anxious or fearful. ADHD and anxiety are powerful risk factors for addiction. Professor Yvette Glover of Imperial College London found stress caused by rows with or violence by a partner was particularly damaging, according to a BBC report. Experts blame high levels of the stress hormone cortisol crossing the placenta. Professor Glover found high cortisol in the amniotic fluid bathing the baby in the womb tallied with the damage. The study's results are consistent with previous evidence that stress on the mother during pregnancy affects the brain of the infant, with long-term and possibly permanent effects. This is where the father comes in, because the quality of the relationship with her partner is often a woman's best protection from stress, or, on the other hand, the greatest source of it. Women who were pregnant at the time of the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, and who suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as a result of witnessing the disaster, passed on their stress effects to their newborns. At 1 year of age, these infants had abnormal levels of the stress hormone cortisol. We might wonder if this was not a postnatal effect of the mother's PTSD. However, the greatest change was noted in infants whose mothers were in the last 3 months of pregnancy on September 11th, 2001. So the fact that the stage of pregnancy a woman was at when the tragedy occurred was correlated with the degree of cortisol abnormality suggests that we are looking at an in utero effect. It turns out that during gestation, just as after birth, brain systems undergo sensitive periods of development. It has been demonstrated that both animals and humans who experience the stress of their mothers during pregnancy are more likely to have disturbed stress control mechanisms long after birth, creating a risk factor for addiction. Maternal stress during pregnancy can, for example, increase the offspring's sensitivity to alcohol. As mentioned, a relative scarcity of dopamine receptors also elevates the addiction risk. We've done work, and a lot of other people have done work, showing that essentially the number and density of dopamine receptors in these receptive areas is determined in utero, psychiatric researcher Dr. Bruce Perry told me in an interview. For these reasons, adoption studies cannot decide questions of genetic inheritance. Any woman who has to give up her baby for adoption is, by definition, a stressed woman. She is stressed not just because she knows she'll be separated from her baby, but primarily because if she wasn't stressed in the first place, she never would have had to consider giving up her child. The pregnancy was unwanted, or the mother was poor, single, or in a bad relationship, or she was an immature teenager who conceived involuntarily, or was a drug user, or was raped, or confronted by some other adversity. Any of these situations would be enough to impose tremendous stress on any person, and so for many months, the developing fetus would be exposed to high cortisol levels through the placenta. A proclivity for addiction is one possible consequence. It is commonly assumed, with no scientific basis, that if a condition runs in a family, appearing in successive generations, it must be genetic. Yet as we have seen, for example, with my downtown East Side patients, pre- and postnatal environments can be recreated from one generation to the next in a way that would impair a child's healthy development without any genetic contribution. Parenting styles are often inherited epigenetically, that is, passed on biologically, but not through DNA transmission from parent to child. Why then are narrow genetic assumptions so widely accepted, and in particular, so enthusiastically embraced by the media? The neglect of developmental science is one factor. Our preference for a simple and quickly understood explanation is another, as is our tendency to look for one-to-one causations for almost everything. Life, in its wondrous complexity, does not conform to such easy reductions. There is a psychological fact that, I believe, provides a powerful incentive for people to cling to genetic theories. We human beings don't like feeling responsible, as individuals for our own actions, as parents for our children's hurts, or as a society for our many failings. Genetics, that neutral, impassive, impersonal handmaiden of nature, would absolve us of responsibility and of its ominous shadow. Guilt. If genetics ruled our fate, we would not need to blame ourselves or anyone else. Genetic explanations take us off the hook. The possibility does not occur to us that we can accept or assign responsibility without taking on the useless baggage of guilt or blame. More daunting for those who hope for scientific and social progress, the genetic argument is easily used to justify all kinds of inequalities and injustices that are otherwise hard to defend. It serves a deeply conservative function. If a phenomenon like addiction is determined mostly by biological heredity, we are spared from having to look at how our social environment supports, or does not support, the parents of young children, at how social attitudes, prejudices, and policies burden, stress, and exclude certain segments of the population, and thereby increase their propensity for addiction. The writer Louis Menand said it well in a New Yorker article. "It's all in the genes, an explanation for the way things are that does not threaten the way things are. Why should someone feel unhappy or engage in antisocial behavior when that person is living in the freest and most prosperous nation on earth? It can't be the system. There must be a flaw in the wiring somewhere." Succumbing to the common human urge to absolve ourselves of responsibility, our culture has too avidly embraced genetic fundamentalism. That leaves us far less empowered to deal either actively or proactively with the tragedy of addiction. We ignore the good news that nothing is irrevocably dictated by our genes, and that therefore there is much we can do. Part 5. The Addiction Process and the Addictive Personality. Anyone who is not totally dead to himself will soon find that he is tempted and overcome by piddling and frivolous things. Whoever is weak in spirit, given to the flesh, and inclined to sensual things can, but only with great difficulty, drag himself away from his earthly desires. Therefore, he is often gloomy and sad when he is trying to pull himself away from them, and easily gives in to anger should someone attempt to oppose him. Thomas A. Kempis, 15th Century Christian Mystic, The Imitation of Christ. Chapter 20. Avoid, I'll do anything to avoid. There are almost as many addictions as there are people. In the Brahmajala Sutta, the spiritual master Gotama identifies many pleasures as potentially addictive. "Some ascetics and Brahmins remain addicted to attending such shows as dancing, singing, music, displays, recitations, hand music, cymbals and drums, fairy shows, combats of elephants, buffaloes, bulls, rams, maneuvers, military parades, disputation and debate, rubbing the body with shampoos and cosmetics, bracelets, headbands, fancy sticks, unedifying conversation about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, food, drink, clothes, heroes, speculation about land and sea, talk of being and non-being." Gotama, known to us as the Buddha, lived and taught about 2,500 years ago in what are now Nepal and northern India. Today, he might also include in his sermon sugar, caffeine, talk shows, gourmet cooking, music buying, right or left-wing politics, internet cafes, cell phones, the CFL or NFL or NHL, the New York Times, the National Enquirer, CNN, BBC, aerobic exercise, crossword puzzles, meditation, religion, gardening, or golf. In the final analysis, it's not the activity or object itself that defines an addiction, but our relationship to whatever is the external focus of our attention or behavior. Just as it's possible to drink alcohol without becoming addicted to it, so one can engage in any activity without addiction. On the other hand, no matter how valuable or worthy an activity may be, one can relate to it in an addicted way. Let's recall here our definition of addiction. Any repeated behavior, substance-related or not, in which a person feels compelled to persist regardless of its negative impact on his life and the lives of others. The distinguishing features of any addiction are compulsion, preoccupation, impaired control, persistence, relapse, and craving. Although the form and focus of addictions may vary, the same set of dynamics is at the root of them all. Dr. Aviel Goodman writes, "All addictive disorders, whatever types of behaviors that characterize them, share the underlying psychobiological process which I call the addictive process. It's just as Dr. Goodman suggests. Addictions are not a collection of distinct disorders, but the manifestations of an underlying process that can be expressed in many ways. The addictive process, I will refer to it as the addiction process, governs all addictions and involves the same neurological and psychological malfunctions. The differences are only a matter of degree." There is plenty of evidence for such a unitary view. Substance addictions are often linked to one another, and chronic substance users are highly likely to have more than one drug habit. For example, the majority of cocaine addicts also have or have had active alcohol addiction. In turn, about 70% of alcoholics are heavy smokers, compared with only 10% of the general population. I don't believe I've ever seen an injection drug user at the Portland Clinic who wasn't also addicted to nicotine. Often, nicotine was their entry drug, the first mood-altering chemical they'd become hooked on as adolescents. In research surveys, more than half of opiate addicts have been found to be alcoholics, as have the vast majority of cocaine and amphetamine addicts, and many cannabis addicts as well. Both animal and human researches have demonstrated that common brain systems, brain chemicals, and pharmacological mechanisms underlie alcohol and other substance addictions. All addictions, substance-related or not, share states of mind such as craving and shame, and behaviors such as deception, manipulation, and relapse. On the neurobiological level, all addictions engage the brain's attachment reward and incentive motivation systems, which, in turn, escape from regulation by the thinking and impulse control areas of the cortex. We explored this process in detail in the previous section on drug addiction. What does research show us about the non-substance addictions? Let's look at pathological gambling. Scientific work on this addiction is in its early stages, but as one researcher of pathological gambling writes, preliminary results suggest the involvement of similar brain regions in drug and non-drug related urges. Gamblers have abnormalities in the dopamine system, as well as in neurotransmitters other than dopamine. For example, like drug addicts, gamblers have diminished levels of serotonin, a brain chemical that helps to regulate moods and control impulses. One study compared physiological responses to a game of blackjack in two groups, pathological gamblers and casual players. Elevations of important neurotransmitters, especially dopamine, were much higher among the gamblers. That is, the brain's incentive motivation system was much more activated, just as with drug addictions. And the same areas light up on the brain imaging of gamblers as in drug addicts. Pathological gamblers behave like drug addicts, or, to a lesser extent, like me. More than 40 people have been banned from BC casinos over the past 3 years for leaving their children alone in the car while they go inside, a Vancouver newspaper reported in July 2006. Some children were discovered in casino parking lots in this province as late as 3 a.m. It's safe to say that any pursuit, natural or artificial, that induces a feeling of increased motivation and reward, shopping, driving, sex, eating, TV watching, extreme sports, and so on, will activate the same brain systems as drug addictions. In an MRI study, for example, playing with monetary incentives lit up the brain areas also aroused in the course of drug intake. PET scanning revealed that the playing of video games raises dopamine levels in the incentive motivation circuits. Personal history and temperament will decide which activities produce this effect for any particular individual, but the process is always the same. For someone with a relative shortage of dopamine receptors, it's whichever activity best releases extra quantities of this euphoric and invigorating neurotransmitter that will become the object of addictive pursuit. In effect, people become addicted to their own brain chemicals. When caught in the urgent fever of my compact disc hunt, for instance, it's that hit of dopamine I'm after. The evidence is compelling in the case of overeating, where we most clearly see that a natural and essential activity can become the target of faulty incentive reward circuits, aided and abetted by deficient self-regulation. PET imaging studies in addictive eaters have, predictably, implicated the brain dopamine system. As with drug addicts, obese people have diminished dopamine receptors. In one study, the more obese the subjects were, the fewer dopamine receptors they had. Recall that reduced numbers of dopamine receptors can be both a consequence of chronic drug use and a risk factor for addiction. Junk foods and sugar are also chemically addictive because of their effect on the brain's intrinsic narcotics, the endorphins. Sugar, for example, provides a quick fix of endorphins and also temporarily raises levels of the mood chemical serotonin. This effect can be prevented by an injection of the opiate-blocking drug naloxone, the same substance used to resuscitate addicts who overdose on heroin. Naloxone also blocks the comforting effects of fat. It is becoming apparent that eating and drug disorders share a common neuroanatomic and neurochemical basis, conclude two experts on addiction and related disorders. Not only are the identical incentive motivation and attachment reward circuits impaired in the brains of overeaters and drug addicts, so are the impulse regulating functions of the cortex. Some evidence suggests a decision-making impairment in obese patients, a recent article in the Journal of the American Medical Association pointed out. For example, very obese individuals score worse than substance abusers in the Iowa gambling test, a paradigm that also relies on the integrity of the right PFC, prefrontal cortex, for execution. The same authors noted that obese people are more prone to stress since their hormonal stress response apparatus is disturbed, another characteristic in common with other addicts. Compulsive shoppers experience the same mental and emotional processes when engaged in their addiction. The thinking parts of the brain go on furlough. In a brain imaging study conducted at the University of Münster, Germany, scientists found reduced activation in brain areas associated with working memory and reasoning, and, on the other hand, increased activation in areas involved in processing of emotions, when even ordinary consumers were engaged in choosing between different brand names of a given product. Under logo capitalism, it turns out, the vaunted market forces are largely unconscious, a feature of addiction that advertising agencies well understand. In previous work, the electrical discharges of the brain circuits governing pleasure were also found to be in overdrive during shopping, in contrast to the rationality circuits. Neurologist Michael Deppe, the lead researcher, said that the more expensive the product, the crazier the shoppers get. And when buying really expensive products, the part of the brain dealing with rational thought has reduced its activity to almost zero. The stimulation of emotional centers shows that shopping is a stress relief. Addictions are often interchangeable, a fact that further buttresses the unitary theory that there's a common addiction process. Although my addictive tendencies are most obvious in my compact disc buying habit, I can shift seamlessly into other obsessive activities. The week we moved into our present home, 24 years ago, I attended the birthing of 6 babies, most of them at night. I'd accepted into my practice 15 women whose due dates came that month, about 10 too many for a busy family physician. I couldn't say no to being wanted. During the day, when not at the maternity hospital, I was working in my office. You can just imagine how much energy and presence I had left for my family. I have thrown myself equally blindly and avidly into political work and other pursuits. I've even had several of my addictions up and running at the same time. That is, the addiction process was active and looking for more and more external trophies to capture. For all that, the anxiety, ennui, and fear of the void driving the whole operation rarely abated. The less respectable and more harmful behavioral addictions play themselves out in the same way. Dr. Aviel Goodman has drawn this conclusion from research showing a significant overlap between his area of study, sex addiction, and other addictions such as compulsive shopping, substance dependence, and pathological gambling. In other words, many sex addicts will also have one or more of these superficially different addictions. Pathological gamblers, too, are highly likely to fall under the sway of other destructive habits. About half of them are alcoholics, and the vast majority are addicted to nicotine. And the more severe a person's gambling, the stronger the addiction to alcohol and smoking. Finally, the phenomena of tolerance and withdrawal are also connected with behavioral addictions, if not nearly to the same degree as with drug addictions. Tolerance means needing more and more of the same hit to get the same effect, that is, the same dopamine high. I usually begin my CD buying binges with only one or two discs, but with each purchase, the craving increases. In the end, I'm hauling home hundreds of dollars worth of recorded music every time I visit that den of iniquity, Sakura's music store. Withdrawal consists of irritability, a generally glum mood, restlessness, and a sense of aimlessness. No doubt it has its chemical components. I'm experiencing the effect of diminished dopamine and endorphin levels. Other non-substance addicts experience similar symptoms after abruptly stopping whatever behavior they were binging with. The journey from addictive self-indulgence to depression is rapid and inexorable. I'm working on sifting through my need for extremes in my life, the gifted writer Stephen Reed, now in jail for bank robbery, told me. Needing extremes, the addict leaps from one behavior to another. There may be a million stories in the Naked City, as an old New York cop program claimed, but there's only one addiction process. While I was writing this book, my son Daniel served as my first editor. During the course of our mutual work, we've had many discussions on addiction, and I asked him to write down his thoughts. His words illustrate how the addiction process can change its forms of expression without altering its basic nature. Whatever gets you through the night. Dad, I remember laughing derisively at age 14 when you told me you were a CD addict. It sounded cushy, absurd. It also sounded like an excuse. Suddenly you had a problem, a pet alibi for being so erratic and absent-minded. The constant blare of classical music in our home was now further evidence of your pain. The Mahler shaking my bedroom ceiling was a reminder of your complexity. Was I supposed to feel sorry for you? I didn't know, nor did I care much to imagine what void you were striving to fill. All I knew about it was what I inferred from the cycles of your behavior. It was more important to you than the family was, than I was. I found this all a bit too pathetic, and I disdained this addiction business because I thought it was bogus, and at the same time resented it because I knew it was on some level valid. So as you can imagine, I've never been eager to apply the term addicted to myself, even when the evidence points that way. Part of the spin job is, hey, I can't be addicted. I don't have a central addiction like my dad. Maybe I've had a series of them, little ones, but they never last. They neither run nor ruin my life utterly. I imagine Woody Allen making comic hay out of that setup. Honest, sweetheart, I could never become an alcoholic. I'm horrible with commitment. I could even coin a new term, ADD-iction, the inability to concentrate on one bad habit for any length of time. I could name such seemingly innocuous things as a blog I kept in New York after I arrived there for grad school, and the series of personal development workshops I took several years ago. These are just two recent examples. In each case, my involvement started out as a very positive thing in my life, full of vigor and excitement, before it morphed into an all-consuming and counterproductive force. The blog began as a way of channeling my excitement about being in a new environment. During those nervous first months of grad school, I wrote in my blog sometimes for 3 or 4 hours a day or night, instead of making time for social activities or exercise or sleep or even schoolwork. In short, life. I felt compelled by some strange muse to push the blog envelope by including more and more private details about my life. It was like some wondrous Seussian contraption. I fed myself, like raw material, into the Blogmatic 3000, and out came a vivid, clever, sparkling artifact, so much more interesting and well-defined than my actual life as I knew it. I recall that even you and Mom, and many of my friends, lapped it up for a time, until it crossed that invisible line between self-expression and self-obsession. And then you let me know I'd crossed it. I'd surfed atop a wave of glowing attention, and so when it crashed, I was genuinely perplexed. Personal development took much the same course, no pun intended, except that it was even more positive off the top. It transformed my life in a number of wonderful ways, but then it became my life in a way that didn't work. I got to the point where I was living only to have something to talk about in the workshops, which for me couldn't occur frequently enough to keep pace with my galloping conviction that I was a fraud. Meanwhile, I was trying to sell everyone on how transformed I was, and mightn't they, too, benefit from this? I knew the word among friends and family was that I was getting weird, but I saw no other way than to keep pushing. When I'm addicted, there I said it, there's a tremendous amount of drama, from the ecstatic rush of the honeymoon period all the way through to the crashing finale when I realize this is bad for me and that it's gotten out of control, and I swear off it with a heroic mix of regret, shame, and sober-sounding resolve. This happened with the blog, my transformational crusade, and plenty of other little episodes. That's certainly part of addiction's sick appeal. Say what you want about it, it's pretty entertaining. Oddly enough, the addiction really isn't over until I can see the emptiness, in a Buddhist sense, of the behavior. Not good, not evil, and certainly not exciting. Just an outside thing I've been using unintelligently to dull the suffering edge of life. I say unintelligently because no addiction in the history of the world ever alleviated more suffering than it ended up causing. So it turns out I'm not so different from you, Dad. I, too, carry a void inside. Nothing exotic, just an ordinary human despair, fear, anxiety factory. And mine will try to feed on anything that gives me an instant sense of self-definition, purpose, or worth. If I want to be quippy about it, it's a void I will do anything to avoid. I may not do it with drugs or gambling or, God forbid, Beethoven. But my way can be as noxious to me as yours is to you. If I've learned anything, it's that I have to be responsible for my own fear of emptiness. The fear is not personal. On the contrary, it's pretty much universal. But I got the void I got, and it's not going anywhere. When I can recognize that, I don't make the mistake of confusing it with who I am, or worse, expending a lot of energy trying to make it go away by any available means. Instead, I can be vigilant, patient, and good-humored with it. Love, Daniel. Chapter 21. Too much time on external things. The addiction-prone personality. There is something reassuring about bottoming out, says Stephen Reed, wryly. A sense that you can't fall any further. We are facing each other across a small, square wooden table. The metal frame chairs, with plastic cushions, are standard cheap cafeteria issue. Nothing distinguishes this room from other drab institutional cafeterias, except the guard, who monitors the prisoners and their guests from her elevated, windowed cubicle. I am at William Head Institution on Vancouver Island to interview Reed, bank robber, self-described junkie, and author. There are a few others in the cafeteria, some sipping coffee by themselves, some with visitors. At the table next to us, a male prisoner, is massaging his female visitor's shoulders, while the native couple by the glass wall that faces the sea gaze in rapturous silence into each other's eyes. Outdoors on each side, wild-growing shrubs of yellow scotch broom populate the hill that slopes sharply down to the shore. Behind them gleams the metal mesh fence topped with coiled barbed wire. In 1999, Stephen committed what he later described as the worst bank robbery of my life and was sent back to jail for 18 years. With gray hair, round pink cheeks, and walrus mustache, he looks nothing like one would expect of a criminal who had perpetrated an act of violence he now speaks of with shame. He has gained a lot of weight in prison. He feels very much discouraged today, owing to a setback in his parole review process. "I binge eat when I try to deal with the impact of such disappointments," he says. To me, he looks depressed. We are conversing about our personal experiences of addiction and the hidden emptiness at the core, which our very different addictions always promise, but always fail, to fill. It may sound surprising to say this about a self-confessed junkie and coke-addled bank robber, but there is nothing Stephen reveals about his thoughts and emotions that I don't immediately recognize within myself. His comment about bottoming out comes when I ask him about a passage in Junkie, an autobiographical essay he wrote for the anthology Addicted, Notes from the Belly of the Beast. "Having fallen through the crust of this earth so many times, it seems that only on this small and familiar pad of concrete, where I can make 7 steps in one direction, then take 7 steps back, do my feet touch down with any certainty." Popular lore has it that the addict has to hit bottom before gaining the motivation to give up his habit. That may be true in some individual cases, but as a general rule, it fails, because what constitutes the lowest point is highly personal to each addict. For Stephen Reed, it's the bare concrete floor of a prison. For me, it's the impact of my addictive behaviors on my family, and the sense of alienation and shame that grows each time I indulge in a secretive purchasing binge. It's hard to imagine how anyone would define hitting bottom in the cases of my Portland hotel patients who have lost all their earthly possessions, spouses, children, self-esteem, health, and the possibility of living out anything close to a normal human lifespan. If freedom truly is another word for nothing left to lose, the hardcore hungry ghosts inhabiting Vancouver's Skid Row are very free indeed. As I remarked earlier, the differences between my life and the lives of my downtown East Side patients are glaringly obvious. Less self-evident are the many similarities between my patterns and theirs, in the motivations that drive the addictions, and in our actions around the addictive object. In their case, in Stephen Reed's, drugs. In mine, compact discs, or public attention, or the gratitude of patients, or the self-oblivion of immersion in work, or the constant need for consuming activity or mindless diversion. I've been as willing to sell my soul as they, only I charge a higher price. They settle for a bug-infested room on Hastings. My workaholism has bought me a lovely home. Their object of addiction goes up their veins to be excreted by their kidneys or permeates their lungs and vanishes into the air. My shelves are lined with CDs, many of them unheard, and with books, many unread. Their addictions land them in jail. My obsessive striving for recognition and driven work habits have gained me admirers and a handsome income. As to morality, duty, and responsibility, if they have abandoned their children, I have also abandoned mine, by not being present for them and by placing a higher value on my perceived needs than on their real ones. If my patients have lied and manipulated, so have I. If they have obsessed about their next hit, so have I. If they persist long after the negative consequences strike them, so have I. If they repeatedly make promises and resolutions, only to relapse, it's nothing I haven't done. If Stephen Reed fell back into his drug addictions and ended up being physically separated from his children during their growing years, I repeatedly separated myself emotionally from my family. If drug addicts sacrifice love for immediate satisfaction, I have done so as well. It may be argued that, at least so far as work is concerned, what I call my addictions have benefited other people. Even if that were true, it still wouldn't explain or justify addiction. The contributions I have made in a number of areas that I am passionate about could have been achieved without the addictive zeal that often drove me. There is no such thing as a good addiction. Everything a person can do is better done if there is no addictive attachment that pollutes it. For every addiction, no matter how benign or even laudable it seems from the outside, someone pays a price. No human being is empty or deficient at the core, but many live as if they were, and experience themselves primarily that way. Attempting to obliterate the sense of deficiency and emptiness that is a core state of any addict is like laboring to fill in a canyon with shovelfuls of dust. Energy devoted to such an endless and futile task is robbed from one's psychological and spiritual growth, from genuinely soul-satisfying pursuits, and from the ones we love. Stephen Reed has written about the darkness, the secret self-loathing that pools in the heart of every junkie. The shame arises because indulging the addiction process, even if with an ostensibly harmless object, only deepens the vacuum where connection with the world and a healthy sense of self ought to arise. The shame is that of self-betrayal. The utter insatiability of this sense of deficient emptiness hit home for me when I was invited to speak at Idea City, an annual conference about ideas, scientific advances, and culture in Toronto. For years, I looked at the list of presenters with bitterness. I was envious and longed to be invited, a longing that arose from my neediness around being wanted and recognized. Finally, I was asked to participate. My ego was satisfied. Or so I thought. Once in Toronto, no sooner had I begun to enjoy the program and to relish meeting so many open-minded and fascinating people than the relentlessly possessive and ever-hungry ego voice in my mind began to agitate. Some of these speakers have been here two or even three times. Will you be asked again? You should be asked again. I could only laugh. The ego can never get enough. It doesn't even know the concept. When I tell my Portland patients about my addictive behavior and how it feels on the inside, the craving, the unbearable urgency, the relapses, the shame, they all nod their heads and laugh in recognition. Stephen Reed also knows what I'm talking about. I've spent too much time on external things, he says, bouncing off other people. Makes my teeth hurt, the work of pulling back from all those outside things and looking inside myself. His voice trails off as he says this, and then he adds, "It has seemed to me at times that you can be present in your life only as a kid or when you're on heroin." A credo of discouragement and defeat that many of us share. A child may be completely in the present moment, but an adult can get there only with artificial assistance. Stephen's comment about his relentless focus on outside things touches upon the so-called addictive personality, or to put it accurately, the addiction-prone personality. Is there such an entity? The answer is not a simple yes or no. No collection of personality traits will by themselves cause addiction, but some traits will make it much more likely that a person will succumb to the addiction process. People are susceptible to the addiction process if they have a constant need to fill their minds or bodies with external sources of comfort, whether physical or emotional. That need expresses a failure of self-regulation, an inability to maintain a reasonably stable internal emotional atmosphere. No one is born with the capacity for self-regulation. As I've mentioned, the infant is completely dependent upon the parents to regulate his physical and psychological states. Self-regulation being a developmental achievement, we reach it only if the conditions for development are right. Some people never attain it. Even in advanced adulthood, they must rely on some external support to quell their discomfort and soothe their anxiety. They just cannot make themselves feel okay without such supports, whether they be chemicals or food, or an excessive need for attention, approval, or love. Or they seek to make their lives exciting by engaging in activities that trigger elation or a sense of risk. A person with inadequate self-regulation becomes dependent on outside things to lift his mood and even to calm himself if he experiences too much undirected internal energy. In my own case, I've binge-shopped CDs when I've felt down or restless or bored, but also when I felt overly elated and didn't know what to do with myself. Impulse control is one aspect of self-regulation. Impulses rise up from the lower brain centers and are meant to be permitted or inhibited by the cerebral cortex. A salient trait of the addiction-prone personality is a poor hold over sudden feelings, urges, and desires. Also characterizing the addiction-prone personality is the absence of differentiation. Differentiation is defined as the ability to be in emotional contact with others, yet still autonomous in one's emotional functioning. It's the capacity to hold on to ourselves while interacting with others. The poorly differentiated person is easily overwhelmed by his emotions, absorbs anxiety from others, and generates considerable anxiety within himself. Lack of differentiation and impaired self-regulation reflect a lack of emotional maturity. Psychological maturation is the development of a sense of self as separate from inner experience, a capacity entirely absent in the young child. The child has to learn that she is not identical with whatever feeling happens to be dominant in her at any particular moment. She can feel something without her actions being automatically dictated by that feeling. She can be aware of other conflicting feelings or of thoughts, values, and commitments that might run counter to the feeling of the moment. She can choose. In the addict, this experience of mixed feelings is often lacking. Emotional processes rule the addict's perspective. Whatever she is feeling at the moment tends to define her view of the world and will control her actions. The same applies in the realm of relationships. For maturation, the child must become unique and separate from other individuals. She has to know her own mind and not be overwhelmed by the thoughts, perspectives, or emotional states of others. The better differentiated she becomes, the more she is able to mix with others without losing her sense of self. The individuated, well-differentiated person can respond from an open acceptance of his own emotions, which are not tailored either to match someone else's expectations or to resist them. He neither suppresses his emotions nor acts them out impulsively. Dr. Michael Kerr, a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., and director of the Georgetown University Family Center, distinguishes between two types of differentiation, functional differentiation and basic differentiation, which, from the perspective of health and stress, are worlds apart. Functional differentiation refers to a person's ability to function based on external factors. The less basic differentiation a person has attained, the more prone he is to rely on relationships to maintain his emotional balance. When relationships fail to sustain such people, they may turn to addiction as the emotional crutch. Some of my Portland patients functioned reasonably well until, say, their marriages fell apart. Then they spiraled rapidly into substance use. Even in the downtown East Side, their moods hit rock bottom or soar according to how they are doing with their current partners. They feel hurt easily and are quick to believe that they are being rejected, and their level of drug use often hinges on what's happening in their relationships. When one relationship ends, they may immediately plunge into another. They are often unable to engage in a process of recovery because their partner is unwilling to join them. They see the relationship as being more important than their own healthy self. Poor differentiation also keeps people in destructive relationships, which themselves take on an addictive quality. I too have had a tendency to look to outside sources of solace such as work and binge buying when there have been strains in my marriage, even when these strains originated in my own underdeveloped self-regulation and lack of basic differentiation. These then are the traits that most often underlie the addiction process, poor self-regulation, lack of basic differentiation, lack of a healthy sense of self, a sense of deficient emptiness, and impaired impulse control. The development of these traits is not mysterious, or more correctly, there is no mystery about the circumstances under which the positive qualities of self-regulation, self-worth, differentiation, and impulse control fail to develop. Any gardener knows that if a plant hasn't grown, most likely the conditions were lacking. The same goes for children. The addictive personality is a personality that hasn't matured. When we come to address healing, a key question will be how to promote maturity in ourselves or in others whose early environment sabotaged healthy emotional growth. Chapter 22. Poor substitutes for love, behavioral addictions, and their origins. Drug addicts have a limited stock of substances to choose from. They have fewer escape routes than those available to behavioral addicts. As a physician colleague in the downtown East Side put it, they just have less in their kit bags than the rest of us. By comparison, the possibilities for behavioral addictions are almost infinite. How then is the choice made? Why self-improvement or blogging in my son's case, and why sex or gambling for someone else? Why does buying compact discs set my dopamine circuits into action, and why compulsive work? I put that question to Dr. Aviel Goodman, the authority on sexual addictions I've mentioned in earlier chapters. It has a lot to do with which experience brings relief from whatever pains us, he said. For a lot of people, something like compact discs would not be high on the list, but my guess is that music means something deep for you, that for you it's a profound emotional experience. And why might that be the case? First, you may have a genetic sensitivity toward music, Dr. Goodman suggested, and you may have been affected by the kind of music your parents listened to. But there could have been earlier influences, for example, whether in infancy you were often left in a room where you weren't cuddled but you were able to hear, so your auditory system became an important conduit of emotional connection with the world. This Minnesota psychiatrist, who knew nothing about my background, came close to describing my early experience as I understand it. I was born in Budapest in 1944 to Jewish parents, 2 months before the Nazis occupied Hungary. We endured the well-known set of calamities that war and genocide brought upon the Jews of Europe. For the first 15 months of my life, my father was away in a forced labor camp, and for most of that time, neither of my parents knew whether the other was alive or dead. I was 5 months old when my grandparents were killed at Auschwitz. Many years later, not long before her own death at age 82 in Vancouver, my mother told me that she was so depressed after her parents' murder that some days she got out of bed only to look after me. I was left alone in my crib quite often. I related some of this history in Scattered Minds. 2 days after the Germans marched into Budapest, my mother called the pediatrician. "Would you come see Gubby?" she requested. "He has been crying almost without stop since yesterday morning." "I'll come, of course," the doctor replied. "But I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying." Now, what did Jewish infants know of Nazis, World War II, racism, genocide? What they knew, or rather absorbed, was their parents' anxiety. They inhaled fear, ingested sorrow. Yet were they not loved? No less than children anywhere. When, owing to internal demons arising from their own childhoods or to external stressors in their lives, parents are unable to regulate, that is, keep within a tolerable range, the emotional milieu of the infant, the child's brain has to adapt by tuning out, by emotional shutting down, and by learning to find ways to self-soothe through rocking, thumb-sucking, eating, sleeping, or constantly looking to external sources of comfort. This is the ever-agitated, ever-yawning emptiness that lies at the heart of addiction. In the unbelievably overcrowded and unsanitary conditions of the Jewish ghetto of Budapest towards the end of the war, I became so ill that my mother feared I might die of disease or malnutrition. In my 12th month, she had me smuggled out to relatives who lived in hiding outside the ghetto.